And so I said, I just want you to know that my parents both survived the Holocaust. And he said, I know.
Hi, everybody. I'm Ralph Ben-Murgi. Welcome to Not That Kind of Rabbi. I hope you're having yourself a good day. I'm going to make your day harder because we're going to talk about something really hard. I will say before we start that I come to this topic from a different place because I come from the Arab world as a Jew. I come from Morocco, as some of you know. And the Holocaust was something that happened somewhere else for us. There were traces of things that happened, but certainly nothing like what was happening in Europe and Eastern Europe. So the first exposure I got, oddly enough, was because I went to an Ashkenazi Hebrew school in Toronto. And like the person I'm about to interview, as a very young child, I was put in a room with no preparation and watched films of concentration camps and had no idea how to make sense of this. And when I went home, collectively, my family was like, yeah, that happened, but we were not people who lost entire families, put it that way. So it's always been for me the difference between someone who has an experience of the Holocaust through their parents or through their own lived experience and the intergenerational trauma that comes with that and the experience I had, which isn't that one, which doesn't make me go towards, oh, things are not going to work out. I just don't think that way. My guest, on the other hand, has made a life and a hobby, really, out of thinking, hey, it's not going to work out. Things are going to go bad. I'm just finishing her book, Kiss the Red Stairs, The Holocaust Once Removed, a memoir. And she is a columnist for the Globe and Mail, and many of you know her work. And this was a national bestseller, this book, and rightly so, having read it. Marcia Lederman is my guest, and she joins me now from the West Coast. How are you?
I am speaking to you in the midst of the hockey playoffs, so my, it's not going to work out, is very much engaged currently in the world of sports.
Right, and last night you were right. It didn't work out, and the team lost.
It didn't work out for the Canucks, but it worked out for the Leafs. So I am, like, I'm from Toronto originally, so I'm a Leafs fan at heart. So,
right. So the Leafs are my intergenerational trauma. I can tell you that. Everyone who's a Toronto Maple Leaf fan of any kind and has given up, or I've given up. That was my tactic, was to give up. Yours in life has not been to give up, but to go deep. I want to talk because we are now in that time around Yom HaShoah, and just here in Hamilton, for instance, there is the opening of a new Holocaust, I won't call it a museum, but certainly a resident place where people can come and listen to the voices of people who experienced it and see things from that perspective in an attempt to educate. But I want to talk about your experience and your parents' experience. It was something that I almost didn't feel like I had the right to know, because I haven't had to live it in the same way. And when I think about the effect it's had on you and your life, it's profound. So why don't we just sort of set the stage of what happens for you around Yom HaShoah and how you were formed by that experience of your family.
Yom HaShoah is a day where I feel less alone, actually. I mean, maybe that's ironic and weird, but I tend to either attend a ceremony or speak at a ceremony, as I will be this year. And it makes me feel less alone. But when your parents were Holocaust survivors and you grew up in that kind of atmosphere, every day was a day of remembering, even if it wasn't conscious, even if it wasn't an actual sit-down conversation. The Holocaust was everywhere in my life growing up. My parents were actually, you know, okay, I say in air quotes. They were functioning and often very happy, joyful people, but they had experienced such devastating loss in their lives that it couldn't help but shadow everything that came next. At least that's how I now see it. I didn't understand this when I was a kid growing up. I didn't understand it through my father's life because he died suddenly and unexpectedly right after I turned 18. I understand it now, somehow going back and investigating what happened to my parents and how that has affected me throughout my life. I'm in my 50s now. That has helped me understand in some way the amazing feat of being able to just continue and go on and live life in Canada, doing the most mundane everyday things, becomes an extraordinary feat of heroism, in my opinion.
You know, I was talking to a man. I was doing some chaplaincy work at one point, and I was talking to a man who had lost much of his family in the Holocaust. And I asked him, he was a religious man, and I asked him, well, where was God in all this? And he said, God turned his face away from us. He abandoned us. And we died. And I found that so terribly sad. And yet he still was a person of faith. He still was religious. He still believed that there was a thing called God. You've described yourself as kind of close to atheist. So was there any discussion in your family about God is a joke? A bad joke, or also if there was a God, it would have stopped this? Or was it like, no, you got to still be Jewish and you got to hold on? Like, where was the positioning?
Great question. God was definitely not a joke. In my household, my parents held on to Judaism as not so much the religious aspects of it, although we did follow, we were observant in some aspects, but it was very much our culture, our the way we identified. It was, we had kosher, like two sets of dishes. We did not mix milk and meat. We went to an Orthodox synagogue. I remember the rabbi giving his sermons partly in Yiddish. There were a lot of Holocaust survivors at the synagogue, but we were not Orthodox. We certainly were not Shomer Shabbos. We would eat at restaurants, not pork, but we would eat at restaurants. And it was just sort of this mishmash, I think, that my parents were comfortable with. It was very much our life, but it wasn't necessarily a religious life. You know, it was, we had the Seders very recently, and my recollection of the Seders is the older men reading all the stuff, not a lot of discussion. Of course, we did the four questions, Dayenu, all the big hits. But, you know, if the hockey playoffs were on, as they often were at that time and were again this year, so that was an interesting parallel with my childhood, the men would go and check it out. It didn't bother anyone, you know, that they were turning the television on, which is definitely a no-no. And so it was this kind of beautiful mixture of culture and less so religion. But, you know, my mother had grown up in a very Orthodox household. Her father was a teacher. My father had grown up in less of an Orthodox household. They were both Polish Jews, I should say. But, you know, Judaism was absolutely at the core of who they were, even if we didn't go to shul on Saturdays.
And yet, there you are a young person. You never got to get older with your dad, but there you are, a young person. How aware were you? Because you talk a lot in your book, In Kiss the Red Stairs, about your regret for a couple of things. One was not being able to ask and talk about these things with your father, but also that you didn't appreciate the miracle that these people were actually alive to have you. So talk to me a bit about that.
Oh yes, I am full of regrets. That goes with the catastrophizing, I think. I'm a bundle of fun, Ralph. Listen, I was a teenager. I wasn't the nicest kid to my parents, and I got to outgrow that with my mother because she was around until I was in my 30s. But my father died before I could grow up and understand what an amazing person he was. He was funny and smart, and he had a story to tell. I didn't know about his story, which maybe we'll get into. It's quite extraordinary how he survived the war. I didn't learn about that until after he died. I heard about it from my mother, so I never got to talk to him about it. I wasn't that interested. We talked about the war. The war was always in the room. It was in the room when we, had a Passover Seder and talked about what Pesach was like in the ghetto, or, any time around food, because the war was the time of great hunger. And we learned that in our house and talked about it all the time. When my parents got together with their friends, they were talking about things that happened in camp, during the war, in the ghetto. That was their common story, and that was what they talked about. But it wasn't like they sat down and said, this is what happened to me, this is how I survived, this happened, then this. And so I didn't know that my father took on a different identity. I knew he had two different names, but that was kind of common.
Tadek, wasn't it?
Tadek was his
Polish Christian name.
Yeah, it was his Polish Catholic name. His real name was Jacob Lederman, and he became Tadeusz Rudnicki with false papers that he received. And Tadeusz, everyone called him Tadek, and that was the identity that he had throughout the war after he escaped Poland into Germany with these false papers and lived on a farm pretending to be this Tadek guy who was Catholic for over 2 years. Close to 3 years, I believe. And I didn't understand that. I just knew, oh yeah, he was in Germany. He was on a farm. They called him Tadek. Or even that I didn't know. I didn't know why he had two different names. Didn't know about it until it was too late to ask him about it. That's a huge regret. Huge regret.
Yeah, I really felt for you in that time because, you know, we were all snotty teenagers with privilege thinking, oh, whatever, man. So, you know, to not have had the opportunity to, as you say, you know, grow up with him, become an adult with him, like you did with your mother, would have been a very sad thing. I mean, the stories are so impactful and so like, that happened? He needed papers. The guy was not interested in giving him papers. The guy's wife looked at your father's eyes and thought, this is a human being, give him the papers. And if that moment hadn't happened, if the guy had shown up earlier and his wife hadn't had a long time to look in your father's eyes, your father would be dead and you wouldn't be here. So all these things keep happening. Your mother surviving, as you describe her later when she goes to the March of the Living, the sweet, small woman. How did she survive this? It's almost impossible to imagine. But the other thing I found so hard, and I always find this hard about the Holocaust, how can people become this way? How can they do this to other people? It is beyond my imagination that a person could actually be this horrible. And like you, I had made a trip to Germany. At one point, I was doing a Canadian Club speech in Baden or Lahr or somewhere where they used to be Canadian Air Force bases. And I'm in the, in Baden, they have the Roman baths. And I'm in the water, the hot and cold water, with these old German men. And, you know, the comedian in me would say that I wanted to jump up and go, you miss me, right? But the other part of me wanted to go, what the hell were you thinking? How could you have done this to me? How could you have done this to our people? And where do you put that in your life when you don't want to become a bitter, dark person? Where do you put that in your life when you think of these people?
Well, assuming I'm not a bitter, dark person, I really wrestled with this. So the first time I went to Germany was 1990, and I would look around me. I mean, I was there briefly before just at an airport, but in 1990, I was in Munich. I was in Cologne. I was in the cities and looking around at people who I kept imagining may have killed my family. This is how I was processing it. I was young. I was in my early 20s. I went back to Germany this past summer, actually, a trip that I was supposed to take before I wrote the book, but was not able to because of COVID. And I felt liberated from that because the people who were around then are not around anymore, or they're too old to answer for any of this. And I felt so much better there than I had the first time, because I knew that the people around me did not have blood on their hands. How did I deal with that? For many years, I did have a lot of anger. I did have a lot of a sense of injustice. And because people went back to their lives, most people who were involved in the Nazi operation went back to their lives. I can't focus on that. All I can do is focus on what was allowed to happen that allowed me to be here, that allowed my father to live and my mother to live. And that to me is like, there's a lot of luck. Like you said, if my father had arrived at that Polish officer's home before his, at a time when the officer was there and the wife didn't get involved, he never would have had the papers. He wouldn't have survived. You'd be talking to someone else right now. But there was all this luck and circumstance and heroism among other people, like this man's wife and others who helped my parents. And my parents, you know, their heroism, but, you know, their strength and their luck. It was a whole bunch of circumstances. So what I'm trying to say is, instead of focusing on all the trauma that has been passed down, and there is a lot of trauma, I try to remember, and this project has really helped remind me, that my parents were incredibly brave and strong. And that also has to come down to me. That also has to be passed down. That also must be in my blood. So no, I will never face anything like they faced, thank goodness. But I can use that strength and resilience to do other things and to keep on, to just keep on with their dream, which was that their daughter would become a functioning member of society and have her own child who is now a teenager and doesn't care anything about what happened to me. I try all the time, especially after writing this book. I say, well, don't you want to know? Don't you want to know what my life was like? Do you want to see some pictures? He is not interested. And my life was not interesting the way my parents' lives were.
Right, right. You know, there's a beautiful moment when your father took a trip back, and he wasn't a person who was effusively emotional about things, it seems. But there he goes and walks from the town to the farm where he lived as Tadek, the Catholic Pole. And the son of the man who sheltered him and the family sees him, and without a beat, missing a beat, goes, Tadek!
Yeah.
And goes and gives him a hug. I mean, that's just one of those moments of humanity, you know?
He threw down his pitchfork or whatever farm, his hoe or whatever farm implement he had, and said, Tadek, and they embraced. It wasn't like now, they were not in touch, right? They wouldn't know.
Yeah.
Something really interesting. I got to meet that man this
summer. Oh, yeah.
I got to be on that farm, and I got to see for myself where my father found the shelter during that horrible time. And I was always so baffled by why my father loved Germany and German culture, which he did. He, as I said, he was Polish. But I realized when I was there on that beautiful farm this summer, and I was in the room where he stayed, and I looked out the window out at the fields, this like beautiful pastoral landscape, bucolic. And I thought, of course, to him, Germany was the haven, even though it was German Nazis who had come in and ruined his life and killed his whole family in Poland. When he got to Germany, he found shelter, safety, food, love. And so to him, his very complicated feelings about Germany were well earned. And another really interesting thing about that is that family that sheltered my father, in my father's telling, they didn't know he was Jewish. He was Tadeusz, Rudnicki, Polish guy, went to church with them. The story has evolved through the family over the generations to be that they knowingly sheltered and saved a Jewish man. And that's not what we'd heard. But I know no matter what, this family is the reason I'm here, I'm alive. And you'd have to think it would have been difficult for the family not to have some suspicions about this guy. Like, why was this healthy man here working for us? So maybe there's a bit of truth on every side.
Maybe at one point out in the field, he had to go pee.
Exactly.
The jig is up, as it were.
The circumcision was a big tell.
Yeah, big tell.
Yeah.
So now you have a Jacob.
Yes.
And you know about intergenerational trauma and epigenetics and all these things. Do you worry about what you've passed on? Do you see what you've passed on? Have you found a way to measure and balance it with other things? What's the journey like as the mother of someone twice removed from the Holocaust?
Do I worry? What do you think, Ralph? I worry all the time. I was brought up in this atmosphere where, as I said, the Holocaust was everywhere and kind of nowhere, because we didn't actually talk about it, but it was there. And I grew up with this intrinsic fear that it could happen again. And if it did happen again, I'd be toast, because I'd never have the strength that my parents had to survive that. I just couldn't. And I worried about that a lot. And I still worry about it a lot. In fact, I worry about it more now than ever. But, it's a fear that's always been in me. In any circumstance, it's there. I'm also very negative. As I said, I catastrophize. I'm extremely pessimistic. I always think the other shoe is about to drop. Nothing good can happen to me. I don't want my son to live like that. I want my son to have a happy, joyous life. liberated from these existential concerns that are constantly on my chest. So how do I do that? It's probably too late. I have a feeling he's a little bit of a pessimistic, catastrophizing, and hilarious person. But one of my concerns was that I didn't want him to know really much, very much about the Holocaust growing up the way I had known about it. And that I had known that, you know, this, it could have been me. It could happen to me. That's what I was trying to protect him from. So I didn't say much about it, or at least I didn't think so. And then one day he came home from Hebrew school. He would go on Sundays because he was preparing for his bar mitzvah. His dad is not Jewish. We were, you know, culturally Jewish in our household, but not extremely, not religious at all, but he knew he was Jewish. But he came home from Hebrew school one day and I said, well, what did you do? What did you learn about today? And he said, oh, we're starting a month on the Holocaust. We started it today. And of course I thought, here it is. I got to tell him. And so I said, I just want you to know that my parents both survived the Holocaust. And he said, I know. They know more than we think they do. They know a lot. So he knew. But at the same time, I was very stressed about him learning about the Holocaust because of that experience that you and I both had as young children watching these horrific films without any preparation. Forget, you know, trigger warnings. That didn't happen back then. I think they have it in hand now, the educators. They know what they're doing. And I didn't want him to be... I didn't want him to have that concern that he was perhaps at risk. He doesn't seem to, as far as I can tell. And the other thing I thought I could do to help mitigate that without keeping the information from him was to talk to him in stories. And this is something I really learned from Indigenous people around me. That stories can be such a good way to learn our history. And so I don't want to give anything away, but the book ends with me telling him a story. And the story is prompted by Joe Biden's inauguration. So I found a way to relate what's happening in the world to what happened to my family, but not in a way that will traumatize him. Is it good enough? Is he, you know, free from all the sorus that plagues me? I don't think so, but I'm doing my best.
So today, these days, there's a rise in anti-Semitism, speaking of triggers. What do you do with that? Where does it take you when you hear people with anti-Semitic epithets at protests and stuff? Where do you go?
It has been the darkest time of my life. And as you know, having read my book, I've had some dark times. It's been very, very difficult. It's so complex. It's so simply triggering. It started on October 7th. When I've spent years trying to tell myself, talk myself off the ledge and tell myself, it's okay. It's never going to happen to us again. You're never going to be targeted because you're Jewish. It's okay. We learned. And then it happened again. The other shoe dropped. And I had to not go crazy with that. I had to figure out a way to not go into the darkest place, which I did for a while. I got help. Therapy is good. But, you know, when I hear, listen, there have been all kinds of anti-Semitic comments and statements and actions. But, you know, when I hear go back to Poland, that one really stings. I mean, they all sting. I just have to remind myself that this is, I think it's pretty fringe, the anti-Semitism, at least I hope so. There are a lot of people who are concerned about Palestinian people, and rightly so. That doesn't make them anti-Semitic. There are people who have, unfortunately, and areas of thought, unfortunately, that have infiltrated that. It's been really hard for me. I've had to remove myself from certain situations and places and people, but I managed to surround myself with as much goodness and community as I can. There's so much about this that's horrible, but this thought I had just this morning, I was thinking about it and thinking, thank God my parents aren't alive to see this. Imagine thinking, thank God my parents aren't alive. My parents who I miss so much.
Well,
can I ask you how you're dealing with it? Am I allowed to?
Throughout my life, I think what I've tried to do is not parochialize, I guess is the word I'd use, the suffering of Jewish people as the only lesson to learn. So throughout my life, I've tried to understand that there is humanity and inhumanity everywhere. And that's the thing we have to work with. And otherness, even if it's in defense of who we believe we are, not sometimes recognizing that we're all hybrids, that we're all mutts. If you start to only defend your team, then the otherness starts to pop up in your life, that they're less than us because they're not on our team. They're savages, they're animals, they're this, they're that. And it just perpetuates it. So I tend to try to, you know, we both come from journalism. I tend to stay confused and accept that there is no black and white. There's a lot of, any good journalist lives in gray. Because once you've picked a side, you're done. Because you can't hear the other side. So I'm really struggling with all the currents, you know, when I see thousands of people in the streets in Israel protesting the government. You know, Yossi Klein Halevi had a wonderful thing he said about 3 weeks into what after October 7th on a podcast. He said, on October 6th, Israel was on the verge of civil war. On October 8th, they were at war. Good for the politicians, bad for the people. Right. So there's a lot that I try to hold in myself. And when people start talking about this stuff around me, I sort of go to my Buddhist side and just go, compassion and civility and kindness, thou shalt not kill. There is never a great reason to do this. So I try to stay there. And I'm lucky that I'm a half full guy, not a half empty guy. But I married an Ashkenazi, so there's the other side is half empty.
There's a lot of half emptiness over there.
Yeah, like, you know, not on that topic, but in life in general, it's like, it's not going to work out. This is what happens if this, what if? Every sentence happens, starts with what if, right? What if this happens? What if that happens? What if they tell me I can't take this in the suitcase? What if they do this? You know, I mean, when I thought of the classic moment for you, for me, would be like, oh my God, it would never even occur to me, is when a paper shredding truck went by and you went right to a gassing truck that killed people. And I'd be like, I could never make that right turn to that. That would never happen to me. And I really felt for you in that moment where I thought, there's all these things that are just happening. They're just benign. And yet they're making you relive your parents' horror. So the courage you had to write this thing and not sugarcoat it is something I truly admire. And we got to go, but I really thank you for this. It was a talk I wanted to have. The name of the book is Kiss the Red Stairs. Marcia Lederman has written this fine book. And you should get it. You should read it. It's an important book for Jewish thought, I think. So thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for the invitation and the conversation. And I was really moved by what you just said about the compassion we need to have for others. I believe that never again means never again for everyone.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Take care of yourself.
You too, Ralph.
Thanks for listening to Not That Kind of Rabbi. If you enjoyed your time with us, we'd love for you to subscribe to this show wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Ralph Ben-Murgi. Our show is produced and edited by Michael Freeman. We're part of the CJN Podcast Network. And to support our work with a tax-deductible donation, all you have to do is visit thecjn.ca/donate. Take care of each other. Bye.
Remember that joke from Airplane? The old lady asked for some light reading.
How about this leaflet, famous Jewish sports legends?
But in actuality, that's changing. Jews are crushing it in sports around the world, and we are here to celebrate them.
Sandy Koufax gets his 10th strikeout.
Zach Hyman, his first career hat trick.
41 points for Didi Abdia.
It's Sue Bird's building.
I'm Gabe.
And I'm Jamie.
We love Jews and we love sports, but most of all, we love kvelling over Jews in sports.
Together we host Menschwarmers, the longest running Jewish sports podcast in the world. Listen and subscribe at thecjn.ca and wherever you find your podcasts.